Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I see you. I've got a remnant that's willing to soldier until the end. Grateful for that. We've been excited to share with you all these last 2 days this week on things that I do in my regular vocational life. But I must say that today is sort of my personal passion around leadership and pastoral work, and I think is what is the missing ingredient in many of our congregations, many of our communities, and that's imagination. So I want to use our time today to really help us all to reawaken. Treat this as a train-the-trainer event. We teach you all to reawaken your imagination, and then you get to go back to your communities and reawaken those communities to excitement. There'll be a couple of anecdotes that I share in terms of the way that imagination comes about, that I hope that there'll be some opportunities for you to go back and look and research these. These are real-life stories of communities that have sort of re-envisioned their imagination that I hope you have opportunity to take a look at as a part of this. But I want to recommend two books to you. I know I recommended some books last time. These are the books that are on the recommended reading list that I put. This is actually from the library, so they got the copy. It's called Intuitive Leadership, Embracing a Paradigm of Narrative, Metaphor, and Chaos. Intuitive Leadership, and it's by a man named Tim Keel. K-E-E-L. This is in the library, so you can take a closer look at it if you want to. So when we talked yesterday about leadership and, whatever day it was, they're all running together. When we talked about leadership, one of the model that I was speaking about in part is what Tim Keel is speaking to. So, but what he talks about is the importance of imagination as the leader, and that the way that the leader is able to convey that imaginative work is through narrative, metaphor, and submitting to chaos when chaos comes. And so he plays with those three ideas. Tim Keel is a pastor. He's the founding pastor of Jacob's Well, which is a non-denominational church in Kansas City, Missouri. In fact, Janelle, who is teaching this week also on worship and doing artistic designs in worship, is a member of Jacob's Well and does most of the artistic designs for their worship services. And so we figured out that we hadn't seen each other in a really long time when we got back to Holden, so that was a very interesting coincidence. But Tim is an outstanding sort of visionary leader who links art, theology, and ministry at Jacob's Well. So it's a very powerful place. So that's one book I would recommend, and that's in the library. Another is also in the library. This is my copy, but there is a copy in the library. And it's called The Practicing Congregation by Diana Butler Bass. Y'all know that name? If you don't know that name, you should know that name. Okay. Diana Butler Bass is has been a research fellow. She's worked with the Alban Institute, which is that group that did this typology we did on the first day, that assessment. She is a Episcopalian, but does all sorts of work around congregational life and is involved in all sorts of ways. Anybody familiar with Barbara Brown Taylor at all? Okay, that's another name. Diana Butler Bass and Barbara Brown Taylor kind of go hand in hand as women who are committed to the revitalization of the church, regardless of denomination, but the church's ministry is an important aspect of church. So her book is The Practicing Congregation, Imagining a New Church. I'm going to refer to this a little bit as we talk today. So let me start with, you had a day off, and you may have thought of some things. You may have thought of some things since the last time we got together. We were talking about leadership. We talked about two secular ideas as spiritual ideas, study and leadership. Study being that which helps us to build perception and discernment as a part of our shared life together. And leadership being the way in which we convey and move forward in our life together. Anybody have any hanging thoughts from that? You know, speaking to the mountains may give you some ideas about other ideas that we haven't perhaps discussed. If not, then I'm going to pose to you a question. The question is, when was the last time you used your imagination? No limits, no boundaries, no anything. When was the last time you can recall using your imagination? Why don't you take a minute or two, think about it, and then discuss with a table partner. And if you don't have a table partner,
make one.
I will say that I am going to be making a distinction between being creative,
right, that's what,
and being imaginative.
Oh,
okay. So I'm not talking of creativity is but one expression of imagination. So it could be that. It could be that's the last time you use your imagination in an act of creativity, but perhaps not. And if you're confused by that, good, you're in the right place. So, last time you've used your imagination. Okay. What kind of things did you say? What kind of things, where have you used your imagination most
playing
recently?
With grandchildren.
Playing with grandchildren, okay. In what way?
Trying to make them see and do things that are not clear to them, maybe new to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Imagining my fingers are a superhero. We're playing with a kid here.
Yeah.
We met little Paxton, and then going with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
One example.
Others.
That made me think of something I hadn't thought of is with kids or with I have two grandniece and nephew and singing to them, but not, it's not a song. I'm just making it up.
Make it up.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I was thinking of if you're on a committee or something, you'll shoot out ideas, your imagination of which direction, if you need money, if you need more people, if you need to change a program, and it's a thinking thing, trying to use your imagination of where you would go with that.
Absolutely. That typically has some sort of confine to it, right? So whereas if you're playing with the grands, it could be anything. Or if you're doing finger, you know, superheroes, it could be anything. But if you're in a committee meeting and you're trying to figure out how to close the budget gap,
yeah,
you know, then you've got some confines, right? You've got the mission of the organization. You've got the what's ethical, what can we do? Are we going to, you know, sell a piece of property? You know, those kind of things. So, yeah. But even in that, there's an expansion and a contraction. You're still using your imagination in that way. What is imagination? I define it. This is my biased definition. It is not by all means a sacrosanct one, although I do have a sensitive ego. It is. Imagination is the projection or the distillation or the exploration of new thoughts, actions, deeds into a possible reality. It is, imagination is informed by our lived experience.
What was the word, the projection for the blank or?
Thoughts.
Thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts, acts, deeds.
No, it's
projection or distillation?
Distillation, sorry.
Yeah, that was mm-hmm.
Filtering, right. It's an imaginative thinking is an iterative process. Mm-hmm. So you're always sort of distilling and refining and going back over and thinking again, over and over again. For example, I'll use myself as an example. I've never been to Holden before. Only reference points I have for new information are the pictures on the website, what I've been told, an idea of what I might expect, right? So that's the new data I have. The lived experience is I've been to camp before. I know I've stayed in the mountains, although these are not mountains. We don't have mountains back east. We've got rolling hills.
Yeah.
I think the tallest peak is 3,500 feet, so. But I've been there, and so, but then looking at the pictures, you know what I did in my mind? I projected mountains that I've seen in Haiti. Mm-hmm. Because the barren landscape in particular is more like Haiti. You know, it's particularly, you know, the northern coast of Haiti. But that's the closest, that's all I had, right? So then in my mind, I then project an image of what Holden is, right? And then that's what I work with. I work with that in my mind. When I talk about it, when I was preparing this, I'm going through in my mind what it is. Now, when I actually get here, that, of course, supplants what I've imagined. That's when we start getting into, well, I'm disappointed because I thought it was going to be, the mountains were going to be taller. Or I thought, you know, right? Because you imagine one thing and your reality is something different. But how many of you do that when you're getting ready to do something totally new, you've never done it before? You start to paint pictures based upon what? What you've already experienced before. Mm-hmm. It's how we envision a color we've never seen before, mm-hmm. right? Or a landscape we've never seen before, yeah. right? If you've never seen black sandy beaches in Hawaii, then what do? You take white sand and you try to paint it black in your mind, right? So imagine the imaginative process is something that we're always doing, but we're not always conscious of it, mm-hmm. right? It's an ongoing process, and I'm going to tell you why I think it's an ongoing process in a minute. But we're always doing it in some form or fashion. Like, if I don't have a screwdriver, that butter knife will work just fine, right? Because what am I doing? I'm envisioning, okay, it's about this long, and you know, I'm not going to dig in the basement for the doggone toolbox. I don't know where it is. Honey, just give me the butter knife. It'll be fine. Right? I would submit to you that to be human is to be imaginative. Right? A core element of being human is to be imaginative. Because, and you'll hear this again later, how many of you are familiar with the image of God, the Imago Dei? You know what that is? It's a wonderful theological term. Can you take a guess at what it might mean?
Imagine God.
Close.
Image of God.
The image of God. It's a theological concept. It is core to Christian theology. And that is, when God created humanity, God implanted in us God's image. It's found in Genesis 1, 25 to 27. Genesis 26, God says to God's self, "Let us make humankind in our image and give them dominion over land." And then 27 says, "And so God made humankind, male and female, made them in his image, male and female." The implication is that, unlike, I disagree with Augustine, but the implication is that male and female bear the image of God. Y'all walking with me? Mm-hmm. Augustine will come along and say, well, actually, when you read Genesis 2, woman was made from, and blah, 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 which gets into subjugation, and it's a whole bunch of mess. But the concept of the image of God is in Genesis 1, and that God creates from a sense of desire or will, and speaks everything into existence, and then creates humankind, and implants in humankind God's image. The catch is, we're never told what that image is. Nowhere in the Bible does it say, and the image of God is X, except to say that it is male and female. So there are all sorts of ideas about what the image of God is that is present in humanity. Obviously, it is not, if all male and female possess it, it is not the limbs or eyesight or things, because it is understood that every single human being has it, right? So even if you're born without limbs, you still have the image of God. So there have been some wonderful ideas around what the image of God might be. One of them, which is a more modern concept, is the idea of dignity. That God gives every human being the right to be themselves and to be treated as such. And several historical theologians would say that when we see atrocities happen, It is because we deny the dignity of another human being, right? The Holocaust, locking children in cages. That is, you, in order to get to that place, you have to somehow say they're not like us, right? Slavery, all those things. Some people say the worth, that everybody is worth something, that God gives of God's self in implanting the image of God in humanity, and therefore, to be fully the image of God, we give of each other. We give to each other, and we share that. Here's my argument, surprise, that the image of God could be the power to dream. If you read the passage of Genesis 1:25, you're going to hear it tonight in Vespers. But if you read the passage, what you'll discover is that all of Genesis 1, God is dreaming these things up. God says, let there be light, and right? Doesn't imply that there was some derivative light, or that there was some light that he borrowed from to put it in place. God decides, yes, let's do this. And then the fullness of that expression is in the 1:25-27 passage, where it's the only example where God says beforehand what God intends to do and then actually does it. Right? When God creates the heavens and the earth, God just creates the heavens and the earth. When God creates the creepies and the crawlies, God just creates the creepies and the crawlies. But when we get to 25, and he pronounces all that good in 25, God created all these things and God declared it good. But in 26, God says, you know, let us create humankind. Now, if we just take the text on its surface, God does not know what humankind even is. Right? Is there any... I mean, we're at the very beginning of the Bible, so there is no reference of humankind prior to that. So I like to say it this way. We are the products of God's imagination. That's such a wonderfully beautiful concept. That every single human being that's ever walked the earth, that ever will walk the earth, is the product of God's imagination. Created in God's image. And if that be true, then we ought to be a little careful with the product of God's imagination. A little more careful than what we've been. But the power of that means that if we are the image bearers, then God, if God imagined, then perhaps so do we. And this seems to be a universally human trait. Regardless of any limitations in terms of physical limitations or otherwise, the capacity to dream and think beyond, even when, you know, folks who have come out of coma, you know, incapacitated, they've still been able to do what?
Dream.
So I submit that it is a human quality. It is a divine quality that is present in each and every one of us. Now, the real question is, if God gave us this gift, what are we supposed to use it for? Right? What is this all about? Why does this matter? Why, if we have imagination as a gift of God, what's the purpose? Well, think about the number of things that we have in our world that are the product of human ingenuity. Everything. Everything that was, you know, even the use of natural resources in a way to support other things. Right? There are conscious efforts on our part to dream. Which is why I go the even stronger step to say more, it's more than just our responsibility to have it. Right? We're born with it, right? That's what the Imago Dei says, that we just have it. But we are to cultivate it as a spiritual gift. Something to hold and to carry and to lovingly be reminded, which is why, as an adult, as adults, we should never, ever lose our capacity to imagine. Right? when I was growing up, you know, there was a point in which you didn't do all that fancy dreaming and stuff, right? You got to get a job. You got to take care of your family. You got to, right? And yes, you should do all those things, but they're not mutually exclusive. We should be able to hold our imagination and take care of our responsibilities. And I think one of the core issues we have in our society today is that we've lost that. When we hear in our discourse that there are only certain options, these are the only ways to do certain things, I always reject that.
Well, going along with that, if the imagination is linked to the Holy Spirit and movement, it is a force that is in us, mm-hmm. We neglect it at our own peril, because not just on a cultural level, but on an individual level, mm-hmm. If we deny that force, it's going to come and get us.
Well, it will cause our own demise, right? If we begin, Cornel West is often known to say, who's a professor now at Princeton University, mm-hmm. is often known to say that the first sign of the decline of a civilization is the loss of imagination, mm-hmm. right? When we have the same ideas being recirculated over and over again, mm-hmm. right? And you think about American society, the number of remakes of movies, the number of rewrites, and the number of things that are being recycled over and over again, and it seems to be at an ever-increasing rate. I mean, movies are being redone that were redone when I was a child, right? And were redone prior to that. I'm thinking of the 14th remake of The Hateful Eight. you know, that those kinds of things are happening. When we lose our imaginative capacity to think differently about things, then we begin to recycle stuff, and that we start to, it's almost like a spiral. We start to spiral downward. Yeah.
Could it be as much the lack of the imagination in the first place, or you imagine some new idea and then it gets shot down? Well, we can't do it that way because mm-hmm. of this or because of that. Mm-hmm. So it's not a lack of ideas, it's just nascent.
Suppression.
Yeah.
Right. Suppression of those ideas. Yeah.
We've never done it that way before.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Which for me is a lack of imagination. Not on the part of the one imagining, but then the community which is meant to do that.
Yeah.
I.e., you know, there are 535 people that live, that work, 3 miles from my house in Washington, D.C.
They work?
They would call it work. And what their job is to create new ideas, mm-hmm. but what do we get? The recycling of old. Mm-hmm. And when new ideas come into that environment, what happens?
Shot down. But isn't that an indicator of good leadership when they accept all ideas as good ideas and then they kind of go from there?
Right. So I wouldn't say accepting all good, I'd say listening to all ideas,
listening,
right?
Is yeah. Good word.
Yeah. Because some ideas are genuinely bad. given you know whatever problems you have to solve,
yeah.
there are some ideas that's going to work. But yes, listening is a core, as we talked about last time, is a core element to that imaginative leadership, right? Being able to come into the community and to hear the ideas, right? The best imaginative work happens when you are willing to suspend all of the rules.
That's right.
Right? Mm-hmm. Right? You tend to have the most fun, and you dream bigger when you don't put preconceived limitations on things, right? That those are the best ones. In congregational life, the best ideas in church typically come from people who aren't part of our church. But nobody wants to listen to them because they don't come to church.
Yeah.
Right? You know, why should we listen to you? You're not a part of the congregation. Well, you know, what I tell church leaders is that the church's ministry is not to itself, but to the community. Mm-hmm. So in effect, even though they're non-attending, they're still a part of your community. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be willing to listen. Because their ideas mean you often come in and say, you know what, we've never done it that way before, but that makes the most sense.
But it usually stops at the first part of it.
Right. Or we've never done that way
before. Or we've always done it this way.
Right.
Same thing.
Yes.
What are the barriers to imagination? I think Adolf Hitler spent a lot of time in prison and as a boy and so forth, and quite frankly, I think Donald Trump did too. excuse me, but imagining what the world could be like. And if it existed under these conditions, and it could turn pretty bad, pretty quick. You know, so I can't quite go there as a universal, you know, kind of a thing, as though it's...
I don't like to lift up Hitler as an example for much of anything other than hate, but...
He was imagining what the world would be like.
He writes a manifesto that imagines a world, right? It's the same process, mm-hmm. right? It's the same exact process.
It's the same gift.
And it's this, right. I mean, we can't go out super slow denying somebody like him their humanity, despite the atrocities they created, right? So it's still there, which to me reaffirms that this is present. Now, if we use it in a way that oppresses and harms and destroys other people, then it's a perversion of the gift, but it's still there. One of the barriers or limitations that I talk about in terms of imagination is something that we've been talking about all week. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to put it...
Well, is imagination, in some ways my imagination is linked to the fear and the worry, and it's a way out. Mm-hmm. William Carlos Williams, American poet, mm-hmm. You know, there's a hole in the bottom of the bag. It's the imagination. Mm-hmm. It's a force. It's not going to be trapped and contained.
Right.
We're going to get out of this mess.
Right. Well, yeah, and that's the hope, right? That's the flip side of that, right? But for many of us, the way that, and sometimes when I do the exercise about when's the last time you use your imagination, over and over again, no one ever talks about the time they got worried about something. But worry often is rooted in a thing, a real sort of stimuli. But then what happens when we really allow ourselves to worry?
We suppress it.
Our imagination goes wild. We start running.
Oh.
Yeah. We start thinking about, oh my goodness, if that happens, you know, my 9-year-old, when I said I was coming out here, she's, you know, like science fiction and all kind of stuff. She's like, you know, Bigfoot, you have to watch Bigfoot because Bigfoot's gonna be everywhere. And you gotta be, you know, his name is Sasquatch, and you gotta be able to do this and watch the bear, right? She just goes, you know, and for her, that's her way of worrying about me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we do the same thing. We do the exact same thing as my 9-year-old. When there's a stimuli that happens, we begin to go, we get a phone call and somebody's in the hospital or something, a loved one, we go where? 0 to 60. You know, we worry about everything. It's, right? And I wouldn't call it necessarily a barrier, but worry itself is not a barrier, except it can create limitations. We'll put up artificial walls, right? So what does that look like? It's when we were asked to come together to come up with a new idea about such and such, right? And we're going to, you know, do a greater, bigger outreach program for the church, and we're going to explore these food needs and childcare needs and things like that. And then someone says, well, you know what's going to happen then? If we do that, then those unsultry people are going to start coming in, and they're going to start limiting using our pews, and they're going to tear up our building, and they start to, right? That's worry, right? So what does that do? That starts to put up a barrier in people's minds. Well, I guess we can't do that program then. Mm-hmm. Right? So in the extent that worry exists, it is the flip side of the creative, imaginative process. And it can ultimately be a barrier for people. That's why people end up saying, we've never done it that way before. Mm-hmm. Because we're too worried about doing something new.
Risk.
Safe.
So.
Right.
Fair. Risk.
Risk.
As what?
As a necessary component of the imagination.
Imagination doesn't consider risk.
That's right.
It takes him.
It takes all of it. So risk isn't a non-factor.
Oh.
Right? Just ask a child who thinks they're Superman and they start climbing the ladder to jump off. Right? Risk is a non-factor. For a purely imaginative process, you throw caution to the wind. Let's try it.
Was that the, what would you do if you knew you couldn't fail?
Right. And but see, here's the thing. The premise of that prompt is to give me an out. Right? Mm-hmm. So if you knew you couldn't fail.
Yeah.
Right? Well, within that confine, then I'll dream whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's not the confine that God gives us, I think. Right? It's certainly a confine that we should do as a thought experiment. But I think what we have to do is bring the imaginative process out of that confine and say, let's just do something different. Cool. Let's, and there you go. So the heart of hope is imagination.
Give God your fear and live in hope.
And the harder work is God calls us out of fear.
Right.
Or through fear into hope. And the only way that that happens is through imagining something different. An author by the name of Walter Brueggemann, biblical scholar, wrote a wonderful book, very short, called Prophetic Imagination. And what he does in less than 100 pages is he goes through the Old Testament and looks at what is the real role of the biblical prophet. What is their job throughout all of the biblical historical narrative? And what he says is, the prophet is the imaginative voice box for Israel. That the prophet stands in the square and announces what God shall do in the midst of horrible circumstances. Which in some cases makes the prophet look crazy. In other cases, it makes the prophet an enemy of the state, Ezekiel. In other cases, the prophet is alongside the king, but is whispering to the king what God shall do, which creates its own kind of tension. But the job of the prophetic imagination and the job of the prophet is to communicate what God is dreaming for the community in the midst of horrible circumstances. And that's the hard work of hope, right? Hope says, you know, we have a lot to be afraid of, a lot to be concerned about, but we ought to still be dreaming. And faithful imaginative work means we're dreaming because God is still at work. God is still present. I'm going to shift slightly to talk about organizations for a minute. So, thoughts about what we've said thus far. I've got other barriers. I'm going to come to that in a minute.
You know, the thing that keeps going through my mind right now, maybe it's because I'm in Holden, is the interesting dichotomy of those many who worry about climate change and an argument that will technologically solve anything that can possibly come back to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we have imagination running in both directions to an end unknown.
I think that's a wonderful parallel, is that on one end you've got climate change folks who are worried, right, and consumed by that, and then you have, to use your example, folks on the technology side, not just on the climate change.
No,
stuff,
I'm thinking
just
about
broadly,
who say humans don't need to do anything to change the problem. We'll just technologically solve it, however that will end.
But you're putting two different things. This is a great example. In the day when we want to be fair and let everyone have an equal voice, and a vast majority of the scientists in the world are absolutely sure, not absolutely, that scientists wouldn't say absolutely, that climate change is a reality, and we need to do something now, and they project out, and the projections, if you follow them over the last 40 years, aren't what they said, they're accelerating.
We're passing.
We're more concerned, but we can't just say, well, maybe no, maybe not, we'll just wait and see.
Right.
And so fear in that situation is necessary, because you have to look at the consequences if you're right. It's not, why, it sounds to me like you're saying fear is just all bad. It's not. It's necessary. God gives us fear too.
I'm not saying that fear is all bad. I think worry is all bad. And I think when we don't see fear as a motivator, then it eventuates in the bad side, which is worry. I don't think we're called to worry about everything all the time. And I think that's what a bad...
But is there ever an appropriate application in life when worry is probably a good thing?
I think so. I think when the doctor says to a 30-year-old man that he has a heart of a 45-year-old, that he should worry. Yeah. Right? It was what my doctor said to me when I was 30 years old. Right?
I just needed to hear those things.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to...
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, you're making a good point, is that there's a place for fear. And the place, guess where imagination tends to become the most active? So, and that's why I said fear itself is not the barrier. Worry is the barrier. Fear leads to this. Can.
Well, I think we're kind of getting into a denotation. What is our connotation of worry? And to me, that is imagining without action.
Hmm. Okay.
Because imagination without action, I mean, it's a good for the mind process.
Right.
But I believe in God's image, we have a responsibility. And so we're missing that element. Responsibility yourself, if you found out you have cancer, to do something.
Right.
You worry about it if you don't have action.
Right.
And viewing yourself as God's vessel to take care of it, then you're not going to be spurred to action.
Right.
And you can imagine every which way to get better, and imagining getting better may save you. I mean, there's
right.
in living in that hope that God has given us.
Right. You're kind of landing where we end up, where I want to end up, and that is
sorry.
That the image. No. It's good. It's good. And that is that the image of God is not just imagination for
right.
imaginative work.
Right.
Right. Because what does God do after God imagines humankind? God then creates humankind, right? And so that the imaginative work then calls us to do that which we dream at some level, right? In the purest form, we believe that God imagined humanity and then created humanity, right? I can't tell you the number of times I've imagined a piece of pottery, and then what I've created is not exactly what I imagined, right? But the fact is I've done that in the faithful action of my imagination. But in the moments of intense oppression, subjugation, limitation, those are the moments when imagination for every human being becomes active. You know the most imaginative place in the world? Any country, you can pick it. Any country in the world. You know the most imaginative places in terms of structures, buildings, or... places in society?
Disney World.
Nope.
Legoland.
No. Good guess. Good guess. You win the teacher's prize. Hospital.
I was going to say a foxhole.
Nope.
Hospital.
Close.
Hospital.
Nope.
It's got to be like Bangladesh or India or something.
Nope. They're there, but they're also in America too.
Prisons.
Mm. Prisons are the most imaginative places because you don't have anything else to do.
I would put Dr. King's letter from Birmingham Jail
on right. toilet paper.
I would, yeah, on toilet paper. I'd put it right in the New Testament.
Right.
Immediately.
Written on shards of newspaper, toilet paper. Right. He's quoting philosophers in a Birmingham jail. If you want to see, when I used to do prison ministry, if you wanted to see the imagination with no whole bar, visit the contraband section of the prison and see what they've taken from prisoners. Or see what they've done in the, when they make food. Prison nachos, which is basically water, crushed Doritos, small Dorito bags, water, and... I think there was you put it in the microwave, you put that aluminum lined bag in the microwave just long enough for it to start to spark. And it turns the powder into almost like a melted sort of cheese thing. Now I'm sure it's got to be cancerous and all this other kind of stuff. But what you have is nachos. And you can't tell them anything different.
And it doesn't ruin the microwave.
And it doesn't ruin the microwave, at least not on the first try. All right, but these guys in this case were sitting around. I got a taste for nachos.
well, if we take that and we do this, and you know, how many times they had to experiment to get the taste just right? Right. But you go to any prison, they are developing things to survive or to get a little taste of whatever, and they're using nothing other than, to me, that's a divine spark. I just, that they come up with anything, right? And here we are, you know, I have freedom, and I'm not thinking in that way, but it's under pressure when I'm denied certain things, right? When you read stories of internment camps, of how people either thought about escaping or dug through things or all sorts of other stuff. Can you just open that all the way? Yeah, so we get a cross flow. Good. They dreamed of stuff. And in some cases, they did horrible things in order to survive. But, what you know, part of that, what Digger's talking about, part of that is fear, right? Part of that is a genuine sense of, you know, I'm going to die, right? And that's the motivator for us to take action. But then I've also got to think differently about what I need to do. So lack and missing things is a core element. Oppression is a core element in the imaginative process.
I got an interesting hypothesis.
Yeah.
Imagine a bird feeder with seed in it, and a squirrel. All that squirrel has to tie, you know, they have all the time in the world. Their goal is to figure out how to get that seed out of that bird feeder. Would that be imagination in some ways?
The only thing I don't know is whether or not the squirrel knows what they're doing.
They know what they're doing. They want to get that stinking seed.
Yeah, but...
So they'll jump on it, they'll come down from the top, they'll come over from the side, whatever, to get the stinking seed out of the bird feeder.
Right, but in terms of their own consciousness, is the squirrel aware that they are creating a process to get seed?
Maybe not, but they know they get seed in the end.
Because if they get it out of that seed, this is how scientists are able to, you know, sort of explore this idea. So we do that with the bird seed in your yard.
Yeah.
Right? But then in my yard, I have a different kind of bird seed. Does the squirrel immediately do the same thing? Or does the squirrel even pay attention to it?
Who knows?
It learns it can do it.
It learns there's something in there that it wants.
I thought where you were going was how many ways humans try to create bird feeders that squirrels
that's the next step. Those stinking little squirrels, we're going to make this feeder some other way.
Right. And for me, the distinction would be, in part, to go back to the biblical narrative, is does a squirrel ahead of time say, let us get this seed from this, and then enact it? Or does it say, ooh, squirrel, nut, get it, right? You know, same thing with chimpanzees that use tools, right? Mm-hmm. Who pick the right size rock to break a coconut, right?
Another one of the, we saw a bird grab like a clam or something like that. And they fly up far enough, and then they drop it on the road, and it cracks the shell. And then they come back and eat the what's inside.
There's a fish in the South Pacific that... does the same thing, that gets a clam and throws it up against a hard rock and continues to do it until the clam breaks open. Now it may take an hour or two, but where does that come from? How does it know to do that, right?
Obviously figured that out.
There's all kinds of theories about instinct.
Yeah, I was going to say, most scientists would say there's a level of instinct to that. And for me, what the distinction is between the imaginative work and an instinct from a theological perspective is the intention.
Right.
What we don't know is the intention.
Well, it comes down to what's the better way.
Or what's the thought, what's the pre-thinking that goes before this?
Right.
Now, the thing that blows that out of the water, makes it complex for me, is a chimpanzee.
Yeah.
Because I've seen a chimpanzee actually put other rocks down to find the right sized one, right? Which is evidence of a precognition. It's happening to that person. So,
I'll give you an example of an animal. I don't know how much farther we're going to go on it, but we had a large dog, an Irish Wolfhound, could get up to the top shelf to get the canned food that they only have a little on special occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to always open it up with a can opener, an old-fashioned hand one. Come home one day, and she is laying out there
with a can by one paw and the can opener by the other.
Right.
Okay, trying to apply a process to open that thing up. So, I mean, that's bringing past experience.
That's right.
That's a true imagination for a someone who doesn't have hands.
Right, right. right.
It's applying knowledge in different ways to come with an outcome.
Right. The only thing is, the dog is doing a present reality,
not a future reality. Right.
Right. Right. So, you know, the key ingredient for me in my sort of working definition is that there is the imaginative work is foreshadowing something that does not
yet
exist.
Something that doesn't exist.
It does not exist yet, right? So even in the squirrel scenario, it does not exist yet. But it definitely is ingenious and innovative and is meeting immediate reality. But imagination should never just be in the service of meeting the immediate reality.
So it isn't necessarily an invention, an innovation of a process that's already been there with the same result. It is more an extension into an unknown result.
So if we're talking about problem solving in terms of innovation, it doesn't just meet the immediate need, but it actually projects into the future what that need is. Matt Bloom, who is a business professor at Notre Dame, talks about the distinction between invention, imagination, invention, and innovation. And what he argues is that, you know, imagination is the thing that undergirds both invention and innovation, but that we no longer live in the age of invention. Mm-hmm. That was the 19th and 20th century. We live now in the age of innovation, right? So in the 19th century, early 20th century, we invent a telephone, right? So that we can communicate with somebody across the room, across the country, whatever. In the 20th century, we then take that and put a computer in it so that we can not just talk to people on the phone, but we could watch television and take other inventions and put them in one thing. Right? So what he argues is that we are in the age of innovation. And when we're in the age of innovation, we're always taking an idea and refining it. We're distilling it into something else, into a new idea, and projecting it into a new. I'll tell you a story of that in just a minute. But yeah, good stuff. So here's the locus, or the centers of imagination that happen. There's the leader's imagination in any community, right? That's when you ask the new pastor, what's the vision? Right? You want to know what they're going to do, right? Or, you know, let's hear the State of the Union address. We'll hear what the ideas are for the community, or state of the company, or the organization. There's also, though, the communities or the communal imagination, of which there are several expressions. It is the internal community, that is the people who are part of that, the boundary. So if it's a church, it's the congregation. If it's a city, it's the residents of the city. It's the external. Those are the folks who live outside of the city, or the people who are not attendees of the church. And then you have what I call stakeholders. That they may not be a part of either the immediate internal or the immediate external, that is, in the community surrounding. But I'm a part of this because my mother lives in that community. Or I'm a part of it because I'm a business owner that's impacted by your congregation, right? But I'm 30 miles away. So Diana Butler Bass, in her book, talks about these two broadly. And she calls them pastoral imagination and congregational imagination. I add to these a few others, and I'll go through this in a little more detail. Yeah.
So often we put the pressure on the imagination of the leader.
Absolutely.
The pastor. But what happens if we... I think... at least in the situation that several of us in this room are in, we're also looking at the lack of pressure having been put on the congregation. And I'm not in the leadership. I'm in the leadership.
You're down here.
So, but what about this putting the pressure, the imaginative pressure on the congregation?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if this is a congregation, then part of the leader's job is to share the responsibility for dreaming, right? So when I was pastoring and I'd have folks in the congregation say, what's the vision? What are you supposed to be doing? I'd say to them, you tell me. Well, you're the pastor. I said, yeah, and you're the member. Well, but, you know, don't you have a plan? I certainly do. And as soon as you share yours, I'll share mine, right? Or let's sojourn together, right? Because what we have is this tendency in our culture, and I think you named it correctly, it's the leader's job to do that. No matter who the leader is, no matter what the organization is, right? It's your job to do this, right? So then we badger the leader. Tell us what you want us to do. Tell us what you want us to do. So then we then can critique it. And then say, no, we don't want to do that, right? We put the limits on the imagination of the leader, right? Instead, the way to put pressure on the congregation is to say, here's where I believe God is going, but I want to enter us into a place of listening. What I learned in 20 years of ministry is every single congregant in that church has an idea, has a dream about what this congregation ought to be doing. I don't care what the church is. I don't care who they are. But here's the other reality. Not just the folks in that congregation. The local businesses also have an idea about what the congregation ought to be doing. The local child care center, the homeless population, the social agencies all have their own ideas about what that organization ought to be doing. And if all we do as the congregation is say, "What, Pastor, what do you want?" And in most denominations, that pastor's not going to last more than 7 to 10 to 15 years in that particular place, statistics tells us, then what are we building? We're building something for that pastor, not for the community. Right? So ownership. Congregants don't like to take ownership of their own communities. Is that true or false? I mean, I'm open to that. I'm biased because I've lived it. I told you I'm a cynic when it comes to congregational leadership. But here's the good news of this. I always viewed people's ideas about my ministry and congregation as an opportunity. Even the bad ideas were opportunities. I remember one year it was a horrible idea. We charged all the ministries of the church to come up with ways to bring people to church. To do outreach, to invite people to church. And our ushers came and had this wonderful idea. They were so excited. They came to us and said, "Pastors, what are we going to do? We're going to fill up balloons and we're going to put the church business card on the balloons, and then we'll do a prayer and send up hundreds of balloons in the air. And then the wind will take them and they'll go all over the eastern region. And then people will see them, and they'll pop, and then they'll grab it, and isn't that going to be exciting?" So I did what a good pastor did, and I said, "Let me pray on that. Let's talk about what that means." And I must say, the first time I punked out, and I just said, "I'm concerned about biodegradable balloons and rubber. Let's just not do that." But they were persistent. So then I had to go back to them, and I said, "Okay, here's the opportunity. How are we showing people Christ?" "Oh, well, you didn't say that. Okay, that's my fault. How do balloons show people Christ?" "Oh, no, they don't." "Good. Now, how can we take that idea, get rid of the balloons, and find a different way," right? So every idea is an opportunity, good or bad, is an opportunity. But what I had to do is give permission to the congregation to dream in that way. And what I did not want to do was to stifle their imagination by saying, "We've never done that before. We're not going to send balloons up. No way." Now, we didn't send balloons up, but we had a better idea come out of that, right? And so, as Matt Bloom would say, that's part of what innovation is about, is creating the better idea. A good idea turns into a better idea when you create an atmosphere in which everybody's dreaming. So the naysayers tend to be here, inside the community. Not always, but they tend to be inside the community. Why? Because they know the community better than most.
particularly if you're long in the tooth in the community. Then you get to say, you know, when I was here 30 years ago, somebody talked about that. Didn't work then, it's not going to work now. The way to really help those folks to dream is to put pressure.
So pressure is a barrier. Lack of pressure is a barrier to the
next. I would say that. Yeah, that's good.
How do you do that?
How do you what?
Pressure.
Put on the pressure.
Tim Keel would say, you got to tell a story. You have to remind people of their shared story. And you have to remind them that they are part of the story. They are not the story. When I found loving ways to remind congregants that this was not their church, it was their grandchildren's church, that put pressure on them. Right? When I reminded them of their, in a loving way, and it is possible to do this, of their own mortality. You know, when I used to sit in meetings and say things like, you know, I am a third of most of you all's age in the room. Yeah. And in most of my church meetings at the time, that's exactly what it was. Which means I will outlive all of you if I have good health. Do you want this church to still be here when you're gone? Everybody around the room? Absolutely. Then we have to start talking differently about our ministry. And what you get is a reluctant, yeah, I guess, yeah. And so then I would say, and it's my job to help us think through our future. But some of the folks in the room are not going to be here in 15 years. So let's talk about how we ensure that when they die, this church still exists. Because, in my case, it was a 140-year-old church. Because your parents did that when you were a kid. And then I tell the story, right? So Tim Keel would say the narrative is really important. Being able to remind people that while we are the objects of the story, we are not the story, like in journalistic sense. Right? So it's not about putting our name in lights. It's about the bigger implication. And that would be true of a church as much as a company, as much as a business, as much as a city. Right? Being able to say that the story is bigger than any one of us, any gathering of a generation, it's bigger than that. But yeah, a lack of pressure means that you're missing, you're not having to think. I think now is the greatest opportunity for the mainline denominations to be reborn. If we're willing to be different.
That's the big thing.
If, right, that's the huge.
That's the big thing.
If we are willing to be different as the iteration of the body of Christ. And listen to our partners and people for whom church is important. Not because it conveys the kingdom of God, but because it's an important part of the institutional life. Yeah.
But just a different way of saying that for Lutherans is there's a struggle right now, I think, and there's been 11 books that are actually recommended, so that we are a Reformation church, as most Protestants are in one way or another, but we've talked about it as a Reformed congregation. When Martin Luther said it's a Reformed meeting in the denomination, it's ongoing. And in times when we're troubled and things aren't going so well, we hunker down and we embrace the theology and the way and the doctrines and the ways of doing things from the past.
Uh-huh.
And we say that's what being a Lutheran is. and as opposed to understanding grace, for example, or faith in the context of today, and what would that look like? And even asking the question, which I think Holden is doing right now, but I'm hearing a lot of struggle with that too. That's got to be done.
So you're bringing up another locus that I didn't think I was going to be able to segue to, but I am. Most people would say, why isn't that over here? And I don't believe tradition is buried. I think tradition is a wonderful opportunity to dream differently.
It can be, though.
It can be, absolutely. It can be.
If, turns from being tradition to something that's absolutized.
Right.
It takes place of God, really. It's the Protestant faith says only God is absolute.
Right. And it becomes idolatry. Tradition becomes a source of idolatry. I think you're right. But tradition is a place and a space. In fact, tradition was meant to be the place where you transferred meaning from one generation to the next. The reason why you did it over and over again was to instill the meaning so that when the next generation came along, they knew it. But why is tradition an opportunity for imagining? Because it also becomes the frame by which you can do something more current, right? I think a wonderful example of that was, you know, and this is my first time experiencing, was last night at Vespers. The village, the Holden Vespers, mm-hmm. right? Which is a part of the, you know, it's framed within the Lutheran tradition, but contemporary, mm-hmm. right? That's a wonderful example of being imaginative. And I can't think of a number of places where that would not work, right?
Yet that's 30 years old, or from 86 or something, isn't it? Yeah.
Which, reading the script, was from, what, 83 or 84?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, so another version before that. So somebody else has to come along and imagine it again. Right? And that's what you're, and so it fits, and it keeps, and what does it do to the community? The number of people that were saying to me, I was trying to prepare, look up something for today, and I was in the library, and a number of people that walked by me and said, you gotta come to Vespers, mm-hmm. right? It has real meaning. It centers the community, right? Now, the question becomes, if someone comes along and writes a 19, Holden 19, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Will the community receive it? Well, yes, Holden will, of course. Right? But in many places, well, that's a limitation. Nope, I can't do it. Nope, that's too different. It doesn't work for us. Right. So these areas are places and spaces where the imaginative process has to be sometimes permitted and then encouraged and then promoted. But that should be a spiritual practice. It should be a practice that's done daily. You should be... If the leader is constantly dreaming, and I don't mean sort of detached from reality, but dreaming about what this community can be, if there are folks in the community who are themselves energetic and imaginative thinkers, and if they are partnered up with people inside and outside of the organization, then it creates an atmosphere of dreaming to which all of us begin to think more broadly about ourselves, and broadly about what God can do with us and with the community. It takes time to do that, and I want to give you some examples and anecdotes to where that takes place. One is an anecdote about innovation, and it comes from Matt Bloom and his work with creative thinkers. So there was a group of missionaries who would go to East Africa, Tanzania and Kenya in particular, to do medical relief. And so they would go to various villages and do, you know, set up clinics, and they would return at least once every few years to check on how folks are doing. And one of the main problems they found in several villages was children's eyesight, that a lot of the children needed glasses. And, you know, so you try to prescribe glasses or get glasses, or what they would do is ask for, you know, old prescription glasses, and you'd have a tough time. You couldn't even match people's prescriptions, but it'd be better than nothing. And so they'd do that. And so the question was put to a group of thought leaders back here in the States by these doctors, how in the world can we meet that need thousands of miles away on an ongoing basis? Because, of course, these are children. So as they grow, their prescriptions change. And so we're always having to supply, you know, and then there's plastic, and it's not, you know, environmentally friendly, all kinds of stuff. So these thinkers, and some were academics, some were business leaders, some were tech folks. What are our limitations? Well, it needs to be rather cheap,
and it needs to be without, you know, minimal environmental impact. But other than that, you know, can we transport relatively easy? Or better yet, if there's something that we can have that we could leave there, and this could work. It takes about 8 months, and what they come up with is a prototype design of glass frames with very thick rims, and the front is sort of a hard plastic membrane, and the back is a flexible membrane. And then there's a little hole that you could take a syringe and inject water, and the water would fill up the membrane until the child sees out of the eye. And then you plug it in the other side, and you do the same thing. And it's lightweight, it's durable, and then the frames are slightly adjustable, so as the child's head grows, you know, you open it up and it moves a notch, and it can survive the life of the child. It costs 80 cents to make. Now, the doctors were floored, because they were thinking, okay, we got to write prescriptions, and we got to send the prescriptions off, and so the first question when they presented it was, you know, well, how do we get the prescriptions? And so the people say, you don't understand. You don't even need a prescription. You don't even need to come back to that village. Essentially, when the child says, I can no longer see, their mother can take the syringe, put more water in it, stick it in the membrane, and you push the fluid in until they can see again. And the doctors look around like, I'll be. And, but it's when you put people in the room and you're under pressure to figure something out, that's what you come up with. So now, you know, there are, you know, Doctors Without Borders and some other folks are looking at ways to do this globally, right? Because, you know, for that matter, can I get a pair so I don't have to keep going and buy, you know, glasses that I have to wear? So that's a wonderful sort of example of how that sort of ingenuity and innovative process happens, right? Taking the technology we have and making it better and to serve human needs. And that's what Matt Bloom calls innovation, you know, using existing technology to create new ideas to meet needs. Simple as that. In terms of the congregational imagination, one comes from Washington, D.C., and it is from a United Methodist Church. It's called Emory Fellowship. You can look them up. It's emoryfellowship.org. They are a congregation of about 110 years old. Beginning in the late 80s, the church was in a rapid decline. Classic inner city situation in Washington, D.C. And the church was basically fallow. The roof was collapsing. There were drug deals and prostitutes around the community. In fact, in the neighborhood, no one could find the building because the grass was 3 feet high. No one mowed the grass. It worshipped at that time less than 20 people on a Sunday. And every time it rained, you know, they all had to sit in one corner of the sanctuary because the rest of the roof was leaking. In the early 90s, a pastor was appointed in Methodist Church. They're appointed by the bishop to go there. He goes there and says, you know, either this church is going to live in a year or it's going to be dead in a year. And he told the congregation that. And the congregation said, well, we're going to find a way to live. This is unacceptable. What do you think we should do? And so he listened to the church about what was the history of the church. Where did they come from? What did they do? What are the elements? One of the core elements of the church is that they had, for a long time, a strong commitment to the community. They were engaged in helping businesses and helping what was then a middle-class neighborhood to thrive, and people would walk to the church. 5 years after that pastor got there, they were functioning, a small church, but they were able to think about doing ministry differently. And there was a point where they had opened their doors to the community to do things like a Wednesday soup kitchen for the homeless that were in the neighborhood. But one night, a series of break-ins took place. One week, one series of break-ins took place. A
basement window was broken out. Someone came in the church and stole some things. They boarded it up, and two nights later, someone broke out another window. And they boarded that up, and then another night, they broke another window. So they called the meeting. Now, mind you, the pastor had been doing a lot of listening and dreaming with the congregation over these 5 years about what is possible, what could work, what couldn't work, etc. And so they're in a trustee meeting to figure out why do we keep having these break-ins and what's going on. And someone blurts out, as you would expect in a meeting like this, we can't keep having these break-ins. You know, something's got to change. And somebody suggests putting up a fence around the church. Somebody else suggests, you know, hiring a security guard, which is something that they couldn't afford. And finally, one of the trustees yells out and says, well, doggone it, if they're breaking windows, open the door.
Yeah.
Because it's obvious they want to get in. Open the doors of the church, right? To which the pastor says, that's a wonderful idea. So this church then decides that we're going to offer a small portion of overnight housing for homeless folks. So in their Sunday school rooms, since during the week the Sunday school is not being used anyway, they opened up and brought in cots and sheets. And each night, five people would come in. The first five would come in and sleep the night. They'd be able to wash up, get a meal in the morning, and then leave. Whole time the church is growing, growing, growing. Fast forward now to a few years ago. This church, which now worships about 300 on a Sunday morning, is in the process of building a $67 million complex. On the same spot. It's $67 million because they are building 99 units of affordable housing. Mm. The same mission that they had long ago, now reimagined for now. The church launched 20 years ago a nonprofit, a religious nonprofit, a 501c3, that allowed them to participate in public funding. That nonprofit was able to secure some affordable housing money from the district housing authority. The church body raised $1 million of the $67 million. The nonprofit was able to secure $5 million. The other 61 million comes from the district and its partnerships. Because one of the core principles of Washington, D.C. right now, strategic vision of Washington, D.C. is building enough affordable housing units for the city. This is an example where the congregational imagination and the leader's imagination links up with the stakeholders, the city, right? And they all line up and dream of a place. This building will be open in October. It is already full. It will include, because this church needed to be rebuilt, it'll include a new building, new church building, on top of that, for the 300 congregants that worship there. But these are 300 medium and low income parishioners. So there was no way in the world that those 300 folks could build such a complex. But if they had used the denominational formula, if they had used the traditional means, they would not be making hardly any impact in the community. What they decided was, we're committed to our community, and wherever that idea takes us, we're going to go. We're going to go there. And that's exactly what they're doing. So, you know, this is $67 million that they don't have to pay back. They turn over those, they turn over 94 units of the 99 units to the DC government, who will manage the housing. Five units will be for the use of the church in its ongoing ministry. It still has that transitional housing ministry going on 25 years later. And so this is an example of what's possible. Now, this was a dying congregation 30 years ago with leaking roof. This is why I say imagination is the real opportunity for mainline Protestants. If we would stop worrying about sort of the things, doing what we want to do in the years that we've done in the past, and think and be willing to take us to the next place in the Spirit of God. There's a real opportunity there.
Does it take a crisis, though, to do that?
Sometimes. Sometimes it does. Now, ironically, this pastor never used fear as a motivator. He only came in and said, this church can either live in a year or die in a year. That's it. And they decided, well, we want to live. As a church, we want to live. Okay, then let's think through what we need to do to be able to do it. So in this case, the crisis is our own mortality, but it wasn't fear-mongering to do it, is my point, right? And, you know, I want to make a distinction between being fearful as a motivator and fear-mongering, which is what we kind of live in now, right? Another barrier, for example, is our binaries. It's either this or that.
Absolutely.
If you don't follow me, then right, that's what we have in our national discourse right now. Mm-hmm. If we don't lock children in cages, then the borders will be, there'll be murderers on your street. So imagination rejects binaries. Always and everywhere. Just ask a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. Why does it have to be that way? Mm-hmm. Why is this happening? Right? Imagine if thinking always rejects binary.
I think that's wonderful. It requires the ability to think of new possibilities where binary isn't possible, because it's a new thing. It's brand new.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, it hasn't arrived yet. You're working at it, and it has a dynamic where arriving is really important. As a matter of fact, we should learn from the past. It gets to be a problem.
Yep.
And the Spirit's leading us. And seems to me the church is just hanging on by its fingernails. You know, I bet you got to let go of it.
Yeah, you have to be willing to trust that the Spirit of God is at work both in the community and in you. Right? If God has given us the image which is imagination, then God is at work in my dreaming.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it is purposeful, as we started out.
That there is ultimately an end and a goal in mind, mm-hmm. in order for this.
It doesn't have to be extravagant, though, either. It can be simple. I think we have in our congregation something that is simple. It's been borne out by everybody that's been there a long time. We now have a model that we're a small-town church in a big city. And that people go to our website, and they showed up in our door and said, I saw that, and I want that feeling.
Yep. And that is what a vision is.
Mm-hmm.
It is your projection of what you want to be, mm-hmm. but currently it's not.
But it's also continuing tradition.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the best imaginative thinking sort of carries forward what has already existed.
Yeah, and we're looking for more ways to continue to be that,
yep.
to people.
Yep, and I think that's also what makes it hard, is because when people are not given choices, when we give people prescribed choices about what they can be,
mm-hmm.
right, then they choose the past, because we know that,
mm-hmm.
right?
But it doesn't mean we can't be big. It's the feeling.
Right.
Of welcoming.
And so the vision there is not so much about size, but about feel.
Welcoming and being a part.
Right.
And from there you extend out to others. Because the church doesn't end at your door.
Right. I want to stop and give opportunity for questions or thoughts and reactions to what I've said, because I could talk about it all day.
How do you decide, where in the process did you decide, maybe this wasn't the best idea? You know, like you go with it and you go with it and you mm-hmm. commit to it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, is reassessment ongoing? It's sort of like a mixed bag where you've got to give something a chance long enough to actually test it. But what if it's becoming obvious that we didn't get it right?
You have to be willing. You have to be faithful to the vision that you have, and you have to be willing to see it through to its logical conclusion. And many times we quit too soon. We quit because another factor has come into play, typically money, right? Instead of pushing our vision to the to this logical conclusion. So assessment should be both ongoing and summative, right? So it should be both. It should be, constantly looking at, are we true to who we are, right? Are we doing the things we said we were going to do? Am I willing to is this what I initially heard or saw? And if so, you know, is this the next logical step? But, you know, it took, you know why you had WD-40? Mm-hmm. You know what started WD-40? WD-40 is the product of, I think it was Westinghouse something, corporation. They were looking for a lubricant that was all-purpose, that could sort of unstick just about anything, right? And so they went to the lab, and they tried the first one. It didn't work. Kind of worked. What was the first one's called? What was the first of the church testing one? WD-1. And then he tried the next one, WD-2. WD-40 exists because there were 39 other attempts that didn't work. Right? And so, you know, and that process was a long time. It took about 5-7 years for that to unfold. But, that's the point is, you know, imagination and living out your imagination takes time and energy, and you have to be willing to see it through. Another example I use are the only successful attempt to escape from Alcatraz. It's successful because we never found the bodies. We don't know if they actually survived or not. They did leave, and I forget the name of the prisoners, but they spent the better part of 3 years digging the tunnel with spoons and dishes. Right? Then they also had to get the straw to make the dummies to convince the guards that they weren't there. But you had your plan, you live it out. We give up too soon. We more often than not give up too soon. And when we do that, then we miss our opportunity. So yeah, at what point? I think it's a divine moment. You've got to be able to discern that as a part of your journey in the work of whatever it is you're doing. Anything else?
Divine spark, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully you look at this differently. Mm-hmm. Take every opportunity to embrace, definitely when you're up here, you're taking every opportunity to explore your imaginative process. But also when you're back home and your grandchildren want to pretend with you, go for it. Well, y'all grandparents always do that. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
We parents are the ones that, I don't have time. But be willing to explore that more fully so that you can then begin to see things differently. So thanks a lot.